I'm joined in the studio by Michael Harpold. He has a new book, The People We Wanted to Forget, and he's here to tell us more about how he came about writing this book, and this very much is your story, correct?
Well, it's 10 years of my story. It's memoir. I spent 2 years in Vietnam with the U.S. Agency for International Development. I was an advisor to the Vietnamese police. And then 2 years or 3 years after the war, when the Vietnamese were fleeing their new communist country in small boats, and many were dying on the open sea, I was sent over to Southeast Asia to visit the refugee camps and write a report for a congressional hearing on why people were fleeing from Vietnam. It was kind of a duh type thing. But after the Vietnam War, we wanted to close the door on the history of it. We wanted to close the door on the reality of it. And we did, in fact, we took 145,000 refugees with us when we left Saigon. But then that was it. And these people were building up in refugee camps in Southeast Asia to the point where the host countries were forcing the boats back to sea because the U.S. wasn't taking any refugees at that time.
And this is quite, quite a story of what you went through, what these people went through. How did you decide that you wanted to tell this story?
Well, I had written chapters of my experiences in Vietnam over the years. And then Ken Burns came out with the PBS series in the fall of 2015, 2016, I think.
The Vietnam War?
Yes. I felt that there were certain aspects of that were missing. One, I felt that those of us who, from the World War II generation who went to Vietnam, that story wasn't fully told. And the other aspect of the story that wasn't told was really about the Vietnamese people and how they felt. And there was nothing about the refugee exodus after the war. One-tenth of the former population of South Vietnam fled. Many died in the attempt. Estimates range from 200 to 400,000, and as high as 500,000 perished at sea. 165,000 died in the communist regime's re-education camp. And these were the things that I wanted to lay out.
And is this something that you have not seen, I guess, told elsewhere? Other books have?
No, I haven't. I'm not saying there aren't. But I myself... When after we pulled out of Vietnam, I was so disgusted with the narrative that existed during the war and after the war that I didn't read any books about Vietnam for 30 years. But finally, yes, I've decided that I have a face of the truth to tell.
And what is the truth that you want out there? Is there parts of this book in particular that you really want people to know about and highlight on, if that makes sense?
I think one of the things that we didn't understand, we kind of pegged, during the war, we kind of pegged the South Vietnamese as fence sitters. The oft-repeated tale about how they were loyal to the government during the day, but at night they were loyal to the Viet Cong. And we never really understood why, and I don't think they really told us until by their actions so many of them died of fleeing communism. The reality was that in no country, Soviet Russia, communist China, have peasants ever done well or even, existed well in a communist society. In Vietnam, a typical rice farmer owned his own land and made a very comfortable middle-class living harvesting rice with a three-month break over to celebrate the Lunar New Year, if you can imagine. The typical fisherman had his own boat, caught his own fish, sold them on a marketplace. He was an entrepreneur, as was a rice farmer. The communists, on the other hand, confiscated the farmer's crops and confiscated the fisherman's catch. The fishermen had to turn over their catch. They were given a finite amount of gasoline to get their boats out on the water. And when they came back, they had to turn over their catch to the local communist cadre. And they got very little in return. The people I interviewed in the camps had been starving. And these were very desperate people, desperate to get out of the country because of, their mistreatment in the communist system.
And how many people, obviously you couldn't help everyone, but how many people were you able to help, and how many people were seeking assistance?
Well, there were two incidents where I directly helped. One was a boatload of 34 men, women, and children in Songkhla, Thailand. And there was a second boatload that had been rescued by an American supertanker at sea. But because they were aboard, the Singaporean government would not let them transit to Singapore Straits. This was an oil tanker that was shuttling between Japan and the Persian Gulf. And it was sitting at anchor in the Singapore roads. And the problem with that was, if no American skipper or skipper of any country was going to stop and rescue Vietnamese who were floundering in their small boats clear out in the South China Sea, if Singapore was not going to allow them to land the refugees in their territory or allow them even to transit the straits. So at any rate, I went aboard and I gave the Singaporean government a letter guaranteeing that the United States would take the refugees. And they were allowed on Singapore territory until we could remove them. And the J. Paul Getty, the supertanker, was allowed to continue its voyage. But and then after my return, U.S. policy was immediately changed regarding boat refugees and refugees that were picked up at sea.
And how did that policy change?
Well, we were authorized, immigration officers abroad were authorized to issue letters to governments guaranteeing that we would take refugees rescued by vessels at sea, by American vessels at sea. And that was a change. That allowed American boats, at least, to continue to rescue boatloads of Vietnamese.
So the change was positive?
Oh, yes.
Got it. Okay.
Positive if we're looking at saving lives.
In that sense. Do you have a little bit of the book that you'd be willing to read a chapter, read a little bit, part of it, just to give people a feel for this story and how it reads and a little bit of what it's about?
Let me talk a little bit about the refugees. And this is excerpted. This was a boatload in Songkhla, Thailand. That morning I had breakfast with the local American vice consul And a French doctor came and found us and told us that the Thai Navy had a boatload of Vietnamese refugees and was preparing to tow them back out to sea. We went down to the dock there, and this is my conversation with the Vietnamese. Who is the captain? I asked. My Vietnamese grown rusty in a decade since I served in Vietnam. After some hesitation, a half dozen men rose to their feet and identified themselves as the committee who made decisions for the group. How many are you? I asked. We are 13 men, 5 women, and 16 children from Phuc Quoc Island, a spokesman said. We are 3 families. One of the men retrieved a map, a page torn from a school book showing in 4 colors the countries along the rim of the Western Pacific, and pointed to a dot off the southern tip of Vietnam. We want to go to Australia, the spokesman said. I shot Hayashida, the consular officer, a puzzled look. They know the United States won't take them, the vice consul said, and looked away. I winced, but pressed on. Is this all you have to navigate? I asked, astounded that they would set sail on a 2,500-mile voyage, having only a map torn from an elementary school textbook. From the wheelhouse, the men produced a compass mounted on a block of wood that apparently had been salvaged from the instrument panel of a wrecked aircraft. What will you do for food and water? I asked. Nobody eats much because we are mostly sick from drinking seawater, the spokesman said, and I dropped the matter. The men related that they had set sail as part of a larger group of 180 from their village. On their first night at sea, they had become separated from the other boats. They had been at sea 3 days, they said. During the night, their motor had failed, and they had drifted into Songkhla. First Thai pirates and then even Thai fishermen overtook our boat 4 times, the men said. They take everything we have, 3 watches, 2 rings, and 2 necklaces. The spokesman showed me the welts where his watch was ripped from his wrist. The refugees managed to retain a single U.S. $20 bill that one of the men had concealed in his rectum. I asked about the herringbone-like rows of welts on the backs of several men. We are fishermen, and a communist made us give them our entire catch, a man said. They would not give us back enough food to feed our families. We are starving. We tried to flee before, but we were caught and beaten. Where are your clothes? I asked, gesturing to men clad only in underpants. Each time the Thais boarded us, they beat up the men and raped the women and girls, right in front of their children and husbands. They threatened to throw anyone who resisted into the ocean. Then they took the women's clothing to shame them. Afterwards, the men gave up their clothing to the women.
And, yeah, and then, again, that was, we were able to help those people, later in the story, shall we say.
Yes, fortunately, and that's a long story. I, had traveled to Songkhla with, the Assistant Secretary of State for Southeast Asia at the time, Robert Oakley. And he had wanted to try and persuade the local Thai governor to treat the boat people more humanely. But he was at the reception, he was openly mocked. And, so he had flown back to Bangkok that morning. But he had introduced me, rather grandly as the special assistant to the commissioner of the United States Immigration Service, who I worked for, and that was why I was over there. I was over there to gather material for this congressional hearing. So I kind of played on that, and, I told the, local Thai, official who was there that I had the authority to guarantee that the United States would take these people and resettle them as refugees. I had no such authority. But I convinced him, and I also convinced the consular officer that I was with that I had the authority. And in writing, I guaranteed the Thai government that we would take and resettle the 34 men, women, and children on that vessel. And they were allowed ashore into the refugee camp. And then when I got back to the United States, of course, that was a big question. Would our government back me? And it was a week before I could finish my trip and get back. In the meantime, the story had been picked up by the South China Morning Post and reported. And from there, it made the New York Times, who very graciously, you know, instead of saying, well, I just lied about my authority, they characterized me as acting on my own authority. But at any rate, I got back to the central office of the INS on Monday morning. By the time of the congressional hearing on Thursday, both the Secretary of State and the Attorney General had announced that they would honor my commitment.
And what would you like people to take away from this story, from this book?
I think, I dedicated this book to the many who, without thought of personal consequence or expectation of acclaim, follow their conscience and do the right thing.
Okay, and the title, The People We Wanted to Forget, how did that become the title?
Well, I started out with a rather long, grandiose title. And the more I wrote and the more I settled on the theme of this book, this obviously describes the core of it. The people we wanted to forget, of course, were after the war. You know, you got to think back on those years. You know, it was right after Watergate. We'd left Saigon literally with a tail between our legs. You may remember 1976 was our bicentennial year. And there was just a feeling in the country of flatness, you know, of kind of like tiredness. And even California, there were measures in the state legislature, laws that were saying that the United States couldn't resettle any Vietnamese refugees in California. We did not want to face this problem. But when people... this book has a happy ending.
Yes, don't.
And as people learned of the plight of the boat people and hundreds of thousands who died, our heart opened up. And within months of my trip, and I'm not saying I solely am responsible for the change of policy, but it was probably that first kernel of popcorn to pop. it was that little nudge of the boulder that maybe starts things rolling. But there was so much other going on. But 60 Minutes traveled to Southeast Asia soon after my trip. And the article appeared in the New York Times, another long column in the Washington Post. And Ed Bradley was filmed pulling a Vietnamese woman out of the surf. Their boat had capsized as they were beaching. And then all the news networks sent camera crews over. And within months, I mean, it was a commonplace to see these stories on American TV and American press. And it really affected people. And, you know, the refugee resettlement agencies just were beneficiaries of a ton of money. And so many requests or so many offers to help the Vietnamese resettle. You know, each of these families that came to the United States had to have a sponsor, and that sponsor was responsible for them for a year, you know, to help them get jobs, help enroll their children in school, introduce them at church. And it, within a decade, we had brought 591,000 Vietnamese boat people to the United States and 200,000 what we call land cases. These were the Hmong, the Khmer, the Lao, who were also refugees. And so it was a remarkable period.
Yeah, and I remember, I was a child at the time, but I remember the church I was involved with there sponsoring several Vietnamese families,
right,
which was common, was churches were sponsoring
right
families. And yeah, that was, I guess, in the, it would have been the early 70s, as best I recall. Mm-hmm. So if people are interested in reading your book, getting a copy of your book, where would they find it?
It's available, well, signed copies are available at Scanlon's and Parnassus.
Okay, and then I know you generally are like at the Blueberry Festival. Are you doing that this year?
Oh, yes, I have a table at the Blueberry Festival. This year, two books.
Okay, and the other one, Jumping the Line?
The other one, Jumped My Earlier Book, yes.
Huh? Okay. All right, well, and I just, time has flown, and we are out of time here. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you wanted to add or finish up with?
I guess that's it.
Okay, thank you so much. Michael Harpold, again, his book, The People We Wanted to Forget, it is now available.